Just came back from Chicago. Gotta give a shout out to my peeps out there, Shy Boys. They got this sick Ill Murray. This is if Bill Murray was a rap artist t-shirt. And I just thought it was such a good idea to do this video coming from meeting with some private equity people in Chicago. We're gonna get into the details of some of the more moderate to advanced level things we gotta talk about in clinical research, not beginner level stuff. And so the Shy Boys really inspired me to like sit down with Daniel and say, hey, you know what? What do you think about merch, man? And Daniel was like, yeah, I already had this in mind for you. And he came out, boom, 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 that's what we can do. So stay tuned at some point for Guru Nation merch. Maybe it'll be as sick as this one. I don't know. I hope. This is aspirations. By the way, are the camera rolling?
Yeah.
All right. It's not just any podcast. We are going to get into actually, I didn't even remember it was our 100th anniversary, man. Happy Eddie.
Happy Yerba.
Not sponsored by Yerba, at least not yet. We're going to get wired with this stuff, man.
Cheers.
Salute, man.
Happy 100. Wow. Yeah, everybody watching and everybody over here, we're editing. Dan is the most consistent client I have. He's by far the craziest for sure.
But damn, I freaking love it. Cheers to that.
You change and you continue to change my career.
And we're going to come out with merch because of this guy's idea. Yeah. You see this Ill Murray shirt?
Yeah.
I gained some weight, so you can't see it well.
But I'm like, why don't you have merch, man? I'm sure people will watch it, like buy your
merch. We had merch, but it was like not that
years ago.
Not that hot. Yeah. You know? But now it's different, man.
We're going to make it different.
Yeah, now we get you so we can make it actually work. So cheers, Daniel. Let's do 100. And Instagram, thank you. Luis, if you're watching, you're getting this laptop tomorrow, man. I heard Luis was running around the office doing patient visits with paper. Paper, bro. Okay, today's episode, it's actually a kind of complex episode, but it was inspired by YouTube's own algorithm because this is what people are demanding. And it is clinical research beyond the basics. So beyond the basics of clinical research, we're going to get into a lot. This is not going to be a beginner's episode. This is actually moderate to advanced, but it's something that you guys and gals have been wanting. So if you are a beginner, just make sure you go to the 4.5-hour video I have. Instagram can still hear. Okay, yeah, I hear some weird stuff in my ears, but last time we went live, it was a lot of echo, so now I got the AirPods. Hopefully it's better. Okay, so cheers to episode 100 with Daniel. However, Daniel, you know on my podcast, I'm on episode 900 today. Nine on the actual, like, 2013 900.
And it's been 100 episodes in, like, a year and
Yeah, and we actually have more than 100 together because we're not counting all the SOS interviews I did, all the ACRP ones that we did together, all the like Guru Nation meetup ones. But yeah, I mean, 100 official ones like this one where we're bringing like real actionable stuff to the community. And this one is, again, this is for moderate to advanced. So if you are beginner, you need to go watch the 4.5-hour video I shot with Daniel. Oh, actually, not with Daniel. We're going to redo that one at some point, but not yet. So, with that being said, let's get into it because this one's going to be long. And there's a lot of details here. So, beyond the basics, unveiling the research landscape. Today, we're going to explore how clinical research has evolved from basic trials to complex global investigations. We'll discuss the latest technologies, things like IRTs, things like EDCs, which definitely EDCs are not new. They've been around for at least 2.5 decades. But there's a bunch of things like IRTs, which are the portal investigator response or interactive response technology, I guess is what the acronym is. And it's where you go to screen a patient, where you go randomize a patient. There's going to be a lot of tech heavy stuff here. There's IRTs like VCT Portal. There's IRTs like Signant Health. There's IRTs like Suvoda. There's IRTs like 4G. I'm looking straight in my site's Versatrel right now. So this is like the nitty-gritty that people asked for, which I kept putting off. But when YouTube algorithm says, hey, you got to do something like this, we'll do it. So let's dive in, okay? Clinical research began. The first trial ever began with small controlled experiments, probably James Lind scurvy trial in 1947. And now in May, I think it's May 20th, it's Clinical Trials Day, International Clinical Trials Day. Somebody correct me on the actual date, if it's May 20th. I know it's somewhere around then. Now we have global multifaceted studies involving large, diverse patient populations. Technology, like the IRTs that I mentioned, have really impacted the industry, and EDCs, wearable devices. We're going to get into some of those things in this particular podcast. And then the emerging trends like personalized medicine, AI-driven analytics. I mean, I wrote this article that's going to release Saturday. So if you're watching this live on LinkedIn on Saturday, there's going to be my prisoner's dilemma with CROs and why innovation. People always complain, why has innovation not caught up to our industry? Like, why is clinical research always last? And there's a reason for that. When you have a lot of stakeholders in the middle that are getting profitable off of the inefficiencies, and even though technology is inevitable, they're all in a dilemma of like, well, do we release it? Do we start working on this? Because as soon as we do that, technology is a deflationary force. It's a race to the bottom, meaning, yes, there's going to be some short-lived profits, but ultimately it's going to drive you, or at least the core aspect of what you do, you being the CRO, further out of business. So you're going to have to keep innovating and pivoting, which is expensive, which is why innovation doesn't happen that often, but it is now growing rapidly, and that's because of AI and new startups. But there's still the concept of the prisoner's dilemma is still here. So study design itself is going to change a lot due to AI. So in phase one, you know, these are like, obviously these are basic terminologies, but phase one, safety and dosage. So these are preclinical or first in human trials, which Parexel, LabCorp does this. Covance, which is now Fortrea, which is LabCorp. Phase two is the effectiveness and refined safety and first inpatient population itself. So if it's someone, if it's a study for asthma, it's going to be the first time it's being done in people with asthma. Phase three is the same thing, but on a much larger scale. So, and it's longer term. And then phase four is going to be post-marketing, gather real world data, which kind of reinforces the research ecosystem. And then ethics, IRBs, FDA. I mean, there's a lot there. So selecting the right study design is not just getting biostats involved. It's not just getting regulatory affairs involved. It's getting the regulators involved. It's even getting the patients involved, where we have patient advocacy groups that are kind of getting involved more with some of these sponsors and making credible, foundational, impactful clinical research. Data analysis and interpretation, we're probably going to spend the majority of this video right here on this section, the majority of this podcast, because for those of you that are moderate to advanced, you already understand the phases, you already understand the stakeholders, you know the sites, you know the CROs, you know the sponsors, you know the idea of tech vendors, but you may not know them by actual name. And we have a few that we're going to bring up, and then the real world impact of these studies. So let's go through, like, if we're starting from a moderate level, let's go through when a coordinator gets a study, because I think that's the easiest way to look at it. Let's say we're past site initiation visit. when a coordinator gets a study, what happens past screening visit? And like, what are some of the tools? What are some of the portals? But even before that, let's go a little bit back, like to training. Okay. Because I think training is a big part of it. So there are vendors. Viva is one of them. Viva used to be a sponsor of the podcast. They're a friend. You know, I have a few people I'm still close with at Viva. They have portals for trainings. So does another group called Firecrest. There's other portals called Blue Sky. There's other portals for training. Let me find another one here. Viva's in another one. There are smaller ones too, like CRO portals. Another CRO portal here. Firecrest that I mentioned already. And let's see what else we got here. Verily. So there's trainings. There's all kinds of training portals. You might be familiar with some of these. VCT is another one. Verified Clinical Trials. Once a site's selected, they are given trainings for their staff. They're given regulatory startup. They're given access to the various vendors. So every vendor, let me just pull up a couple studies here at random. Every study has 10 to 12 vendors. Let me go through like one of these studies right now, and then I'll go through another one so you can see like the difference between the vendors and how that stuff works. So we've got EPIP on one of them. That's a PPD technology, which is a unique to PPD, and that's one where like one of the CROs try to differentiate themselves by having value add components, and like, what does this CRO do that others don't? And this is part of that innovation. Like, if you're competing in a marketplace, like CROs are, you are in a prisoner's dilemma where, hey, if we innovate, then everyone else is going to innovate, and it's a race to the bottom. But there are things we can do to have unique value propositions for ourselves. So PPD does this amongst other things. I don't work for PPD. I'm not sponsored by PPD. EPIP is supposed to be, I know when they go to sponsors to bid for their study, like let's say PPD goes to Eli Lilly and says, hey, we're bidding on your new study. Lilly is going to say, well, yeah, we're talking with four other CROs. Show us what your capabilities are and how you could help us on our particular study. So then PPD is going to say, well, you know, we have relationships with this central lab. We have relationships with this ECOA, which is basically patient reported outcomes assessments. And we have electronic ones. We have streamlined training for the sites. We have streamlined regulatory. And so they're going to give them like their unique value props. The thing is, they're all basically the same. Like some have unique components. Like EPIP is relatively unique for PPD in that it's like meant to be like a chat room for CRCs, like when you're live in the moment, let's say screening or randomizing a patient, but you're having an issue, maybe you're having a question about the protocol, rather than calling your CRA because CRAs are busy, overworked, CRAs might be at another site, you can go on this chat room, it's called EPIP, and you can submit your questions, and in a quick, relatively timely manner, you'll get a response. Whereas IQVIA's value prop, which is IQVIA's another CRO, theirs is we have single sign-on for all of the vendors. And I forgot the name of their thing. I think it's called OneSign or something. Don't quote me on that. But basically, remember, the CRO is like the gatekeeper to the study. And it's very rare that the CRO owns all the intellectual property for all the vendors, because it's a lot of technologies. But they control who they're going to use. And IQVIA is big. I mean, all these CROs are big. So if you're a vendor like Medidata that does EDC, or if you're a vendor like, in this case, it's, let me click on it. For this particular study, it's looks like a actual proprietary EDC that this spot that this CRO has, but most of them are Medidata. This one is Medidata. Veeva has their own. Medrio has an EDC. Here's another Medrio one. Here's another Medidata one. I'm looking at all my studies right now. Here's a Veeva EDC. It's very rare that a CRO will develop their own EDC, but sometimes they will. But they will control, like, they'll have a relationship with Veeva or Medidata and say, hey, what's a good pricing? You know, it's important for us to have a dedicated team to help us troubleshoot. We need to be competitive with our bids. And everything is about being competitive. So when that happens, everything's basically ubiquitous. So if you're a CRO and everyone's using ubiquitous tools where there's really is very little difference, where can you charge more than the rest? Or where can you justify, hey, this is why I'm bidding higher? Well, in IQVIA's case, one of them is we have this really cool thing that cites love, and it saves them time and it increases compliance. And here's a white paper that we did on a study we have where sites use this one sign thing, where it's basically within IQVIA's own walled garden, all the vendors that the site's going to use, so in this case it's like 12 of them, the logins are already there. You're just signed into everything. But it's only for IQVIA studies, so sponsor thinks, hey, that's a really good idea. You know, it's worth going with IQVIA for this project. Another sponsor might say, well, I like PPD's EPIP, so we're going to go with them. Another sponsor might say, like this one here, we're not going to use a CRO. We're going to do everything ourselves, but we have a strategic relationship with Medrio, where they can have a lot of these technologies, and then we also have a strategic relationship with this particular IRT vendor. In this case, it's 4G, and then that's for the IRTs, and then we have a strategic relationship with a payment vendor, which is Greenfire. So we're going to handle this ourselves. And then they have a bunch of other stuff. They still need to find the IRBs. There's only a handful of them you can choose. Matter of fact, I have from my 7 studies I'm looking at right now, let's go through the IRBs real quick. One of them is Kirby, C-I-R-B. Another one is Alpha IRB. That one's unique, but still big. Another one is Kirby again, which is Advara. Another one is Kirby again. Another one is, this one's WCG. Another one is WCG. Another one is Kirby again, which is Advara. So they're either going to be Advara or WCG. And CIRB, Kirby, is Advara. And then you have WCG. Those are like the big players. So there's not a real difference from one to the other. So neither can say, well, I deserve to charge double what my competitor does. Why? Because they don't really innovate. But what the IRBs have done are starting to make their revenue streams elsewhere. Like, these IRBs own some sites. These IRBs, so they're in the site space. The IRBs starting to own the eCOA solutions, the patient diaries. The IRBs are starting to get into services businesses, like helping sites negotiate contracts and budgets, helping sites find studies. And the CROs are kind of getting into this stuff too. So once you have ubiquitous services or tools, price is basically controlled. And so in order to have a unique value prop, you either innovate and create something completely different than no one else has, like PPD does with EPIP, like IQVIA does with their one sign-on thing. But then once the other CROs see that that thing is working, or sponsors like it, or there's an appetite for it, they will just make it themselves, because the hard part's not making the technology anymore. And we haven't even discussed AI. We're going to get to a point where AI is going to be able to write code quickly, like better than a human. And so it's going to be more the idea and what sticks and what sponsors like and what sites like than the actual capability of building these systems. And then same thing with these EDC systems, which for two decades that I've been in the space, they've dominated the industry. And it basically boils down to Metadata and a few others, Medrio. But even they, vendors, in this case, EDCs, have evolved to do more than one thing. So Medrio, for example, can do patient-reported outcomes, which is eCOA. And then Metadata, they're working on allowing data to passively be entered from eSource like Creo or like RealTime, which we have yet to see it work at my site. But they are, the technologies are there. And the sponsors are like, and even if those sponsors are not happy with those particular vendors, there are dozens of startups out there that have the technology. And what they need is to get through the gatekeeper, which has historically been the CRO, to give them a chance. But then the CRO can just do it themselves too. So there's this whole cat and mouse game, and I call it the prisoner's dilemma, because the innovation's there. Everybody knows what they need to do next to make things more efficient, but no one wants to do it, because then it's kind of the end of profits for everyone, more or less, at least in that, within that particular vertical. So everyone's really slow to innovate until the market demands that that's no longer the case. And the post-COVID, that's kind of been accelerating, and innovation has been accelerating. So you got companies like Metadata, Veeva, Oracle that are doing EDCs. They basically have a monopoly on the EDC space. But the EDC is becoming not irrelevant. You still need a database to hold your data, but they're becoming ubiquitous. Like, it's not necessarily where you make your money. And if you follow Joel White, who's an industry analyst, and he's been on the podcast a few times, and he has his own LinkedIn newsletter, he'll tell you, like, you know, these CROs, they're still stable, growing year over year. They're absorbing these technologies. If there's a profitable vertical, the CRO is going to want to control it. And the EDC is kind of not a profitable vertical anymore because of the competition. And if these big three ever get too crazy as far as prices that they charge, or on the quality side get glitchy, or sites just stop liking it, the feedback gets back to the sponsor, and then that leaves the door open for new entrants to come in and play the same game. But now we're kind of entering this era where we're no longer playing the same game of having all these vendors. We're having a lot of unification amongst the vendors. And so where your EDC is now your IRT, which is now your eCOA, which so far it's not also your IRB, but it may very well be. And so far it's not, they are also your site, but at some point it very well may be, because the sites are consolidating now too. And so to make things a little more complicated, the sites are now creating their own, at least the site networks are creating their own technologies. And AI platforms are coming out, like IBM Watson Health, which has already been out here to identify patterns, expedite discoveries, ClueCoins is one that the FDA uses, and I know CROs and sponsors use, or at least they use tools similar to that, to where they can find like trends as far as They can find fraud quickly through the data. They can find sites that are struggling. They keep metrics on everything. And by the way, the metrics things, like keeping track, keeping metrics on everything and having a data-driven ecosystem is nothing new. That's been going on since EDC came out, which is around 2005. Because when EDC came out, everything started getting put into electronic databases. So we had, you know, we're able to actually get metrics on a lot of things, but now we can get metrics on way more parameters, including wearable devices, including IRTs, including patient diaries, and you can really get crazy with the data now. And things like CluePoint are helpful. There's also a bunch of startups too. There's one in this space, I believe it was called Butterfly Labs, if I'm not mistaken. We had them on the podcast. The name is escaping me. But the point is, for any technology that you see in this space, there's probably a dozen startups that can do it better and that are always improving on it. And they either get acquired at some point and become part of like the ecosystem. They kind of become embedded into the ecosystem, at which point those vendors become embedded. So Florence is a perfect example. Florence is an e-regulatory program, and they compete with Veeva, which is an e-regulatory program. And Veeva also does much more than just e-reg. They actually started with safety on the safety side. So SUSARs, suspected unexpected serious adverse reactions. That's kind of where Veeva made its entry into clinical research. Before that, Veeva was the software powering the pharmaceutical sales reps. But then they saw the opportunities. This was late 90s. They saw the opportunities in research. And so they quickly made a name for themselves. And now they are the main player for like safety and things like that. They're like the metadata for safety. But now Veeva's starting to do things for sites, like here's a free e-reg system for sites, and things are supposed to be seamless for the sponsors, and things are supposed to be one click for the sites. And the whole idea with Veeva, the whole selling point to sites and sponsors, is everything is seamless, everything works, it's one login. But the reality is, it's a lot harder than that. It sounds good on paper, but when you're actually out there in the wild, there's still a lot of fragmented tech. There's still site SOPs are not all the same. Sponsor SOPs are not all the same. They don't all allow for what a vendor proposes. And Veeva is very strict when it comes to their electronic investigator site files. They only have 10 sections, and that's it. So that might not always align with a site's SOP, and that might not always align with a sponsor's SOP. But that's Veeva's philosophy, is we're going to leave it this way because it's important for us to have simplicity. But now Veeva does things like EDC. Veeva does things like patient-reported outcomes. So there's a lot. If you look at Veeva's website or any of these big tech companies, you're going to see they do more than just one thing, because a lot of these verticals are not designed to make money. A lot of these verticals are designed to get users using it so that it's harder for a sponsor to move away from a Veeva. So they're more entrenched, they're more dependent on a Veeva or a metadata, or when you get to the CROs, same thing, IQVIA, and they're all competing. It's a giant prisoner's dilemma. So now there's, so that's the art of collecting the data. Now, what about drawing meaningful conclusions from the data? That's a whole nother aspect to this, which some of these vendors come into play. There's other vendors out there when you're getting into statistical significance. So let's say a pharma company like Novartis or Eli Lilly, they'll partner with, let's say, IQVIA. They're also going to outsource, hey, we want the statistical insights. We want the biostats. And so there's tools for those things as well. Then there's publications. So peer-reviewed journals, this is in the investigator-initiated and more of the academic medical center. There's groups like Envision Pharma Group that assist with medical writing, manuscript preparation. There's a lot that goes into it. The data, analyzing the data accurately and disseminating the findings responsibly are also critical steps in transforming data into real-world breakthroughs. When you get into real-world evidence-based trials, IQVIA really made a name for itself. And technology really empowered this around 2010, 2012. I have an article coming out on LinkedIn where we're talking about this. But what's the real-world impact of all this? The real-world impact is there's this push for, and I'm actually kind of against it because I think it's dangerous. And my last video was on ethics in clinical research. Research as a care option. I don't think research is care. Research is research. If research was care, it would not need to be called research. So there's research is, you can say, pre-approved care, but we don't know if that care actually works. So therefore, we can't call it care. Now, what I tell our patients that do our studies is technically this is not care. This is not treatment. But you are going to be looked after safety-wise better than you ever have been before. Like we're talking weekly visits in the case of some studies. Some studies have biweekly visits, labs, ECGs, EEGs, you name it. Everything's getting looked at. We leave no stone unturned, and that's the benefit of research for you, the study participant. But at the end of the day, we don't know if you're getting placebo or not. If there's an open label aspect to the study, of course, that's a benefit, but we don't know if it works for you. And so you can't call research care, but the evidence-based guidelines kind of shape these treatment decisions and improve patient outcomes. And in theory, it can significantly reduce healthcare costs. But, and that when tech, when I say tech is a deflationary force, that is in line with this reducing healthcare costs. But whenever there's new innovations, that requires an increased investment in that innovation until everyone else joins in on that investment. And then it becomes reduced cost. So there's a spike in the cost before there's a massive drop in the cost for every vertical. It used to be this way for case report forms before they were EDC. There was a massive investment needed of dollars and resources into creating EDCs. So then there was like a spike in spending. And then after EDCs came out, there was a drop as far as costs, efficiencies, everything got cheaper, faster, better, and the whole industry benefits as a whole. But those first players that came to the space EDC that innovated, they probably got acquired by Medidata or they probably went out of business. And then you were left with a few entrenched players that are now using ubiquitous tools. And these tools themselves, like we've discussed on this video and podcast so far, are changing constantly. And so evidence-based medicine, it's going to be easier, especially with wearables, having wearables in clinical research. But you're also, that comes at the cost of patient burden. How much, just because we can track more, doesn't mean we should, unless it's easy on the patient. I'm a site owner. I see the amount of diaries we ask our patients to do at home. And it's pretty burdensome. And yeah, the more data we can get, the better for society. But what about that patient? That patient signed up to do a trial to figure out if something's working for themselves and maybe get some answers for themselves. They didn't necessarily sign up to generate data for the entire industry. And there's I think there's a balance between what we are asking of patients to do versus what we are, what the industry is capable of. I remember, and I'm glad this was shut down, but about a decade ago or maybe more now, to ensure patients were compliant with their investigational product, they would put like RFID trackers in the pills. And yeah, just because the technology's there, that's good data. we would know for sure patients are compliant or not. People were not, and understandably so, not okay with being tracked all the time and not okay with swallowing pills with RFID chips in them. And so that idea was shut down. Like, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And this gets back to ethics and what is good for that individual, maybe, or what is a burden on one is a benefit to the rest. But then you're not going to have, if you make it too burdensome for the patient to participate in a trial, you're not going to have participation. And it all boils down to the human being. So all these technologies we use, it boils down to patients being willing to do it. This is patient centricity, after all. Coordinators being able to do it and not burdening the coordinators. So now this is site centricity and not burdening the staff at the site and not making them do more work than they're actually getting paid, or else sites will just not work with particular sponsors or decline certain studies, which I've done many times already here in Yuma. Now, this study's too burdensome for my staff. We're not going to do it. Well, that sponsor chose data over pragmatism. I don't think it's necessarily a good idea. So this is like a balance you got to do. And so there's a lot of challenges, but opportunities translating this stuff into real world impact. Funding constraints, participant recruitment, participant compliance, participant retention, regulatory hurdles, of course, and then greater global collaboration, diversity in trials, emerging technologies are always there. Artificial intelligence, we're just getting started. I think it's going to make everything faster, cheaper, better, but it's not necessarily going to improve the human condition necessarily unless we're smart about it as industry professionals. And if you're an industry professional, this is the way I close this video out. You've got to develop critical thinking. Just because you can do something, again, the example of that RFID chip in the pills that we swallow, yeah, you're going to guarantee you know compliance 100%, but patients are not okay with that. Now you got to put that in the consent form, and patients are like, well, you're going to track me? I don't think I necessarily feel good about this. And so you're balancing data versus pragmatism. And you need it as a person that works in the space, you need to learn critical thinking skills to be able to push back when you come across an idea or maybe a policy that your company's wanting to roll out. If everybody says, yeah, that's a good idea because they're afraid of pushback, we're not going to get much efficiency in our industry. But I think the value comes when people are pushing back, not just because you can push back, but because critical thinking, you actually think this is not going to work, and you need to be able to present that concisely. Communication skills, super important. Understand the data well, understand all the stakeholders. These skills are vital for interpreting the research literature and conveying complex data effectively. This is how you're going to pave your own career path, because as AI has the potential to replace all of us. Now, whether it does or not, I think is a good analogy. That RFID chip in the pill, that's potential to like never have to worry about patient compliance again. But patients didn't want that. I don't think you would want that if you were had RFID chips in your pills. And by the way, we should probably, if they wanted to push that, they should have done studies on those long-term safety and efficacy of those RFIDs, not small studies or not like mice studies, but like actual long-term safety. And so that's actually going to increase cost more. And that's where I talked about when technological innovations happen, they require a massive influx of resources. So that actually means more spending. If it works, and a lot of these innovations don't work, so that's the risk. If it works, then we will see a race to the bottom as far as faster, better, cheaper. And there's winners and losers throughout this whole process of the spike and the dip. But not all of the technologies are proven to work that well or that cleanly. And so this explains why we don't have a rush towards innovation in our industry, because there's a lot of people that have a lot to lose from it, understandably so, not to mention the ethical side. So pave your own career path. Think about what you're doing now and what that looks like in the future. Try to put yourself out of business before the industry does. Continuing learning and development. I can't push our conference enough. Save our sights, whether it's that big yearly conference or the multiple small regional meetups we have, or the live streams with Latinos in Clinical Research, or my live streams I do, and just people that have been interacting with each other in the comments of these posts, of these live streams, have already been able to help each other out. That is networking. Networking and interdisciplinary collaboration propel your career growth. A career in research is both challenging and rewarding. Embrace continuous learning. You'll make a lasting impact on healthcare worldwide. I don't think it's as simple as we introduce this technology and everything's over, even in the case of AI. As you can see, hopefully we got through, and this is a work in progress, but there's a lot that goes into a research study. So let me just, as we wrap up here, go through some of these portals like I did at the beginning. Any that I haven't mentioned yet, there's recruitment portals, all kinds. Some of the CROs own these, others, they have bought recruitment companies, others have strategic relationships with them. I have a startup one called Patient Ace. We're working with a few sponsors already. There's Judy is one, J-U-D-I. It's for adjudication. There's payments. There's electronic investigator site files that we've discussed. Viva, Florence. There's Box. One sponsor is using Box here. There's ePro Setup. There's another eCOA. There's a CT scan. This one's a payment portal for a big CRO. They do it themselves directly. So there's like a CRO like IQVIA has their own payment portal for sites, as opposed to Greenfire, which pays, they are doing now site payments and patient payments. IQVIA could do the patient payments themselves. I haven't come across a situation where that is the case. But all these technologies are blending in together, and there's not much money to be made after they become standardized. And that's the problem. It's a high risk. It is a high reward, but the reward is short-lived. And then you have to innovate again. And as we all innovate, and everyone's going faster, and even in the wearables, you know, there's portals like Fitabase, Fitbit is getting involved in this, Apple Watch is getting involved in this. Here's another recruitment vendor here, StudyKick, they're a big one. Clinergize, this is one where it's a sponsor-specific portal similar to EPIP. There's a Blue Sky that I mentioned before, StudyHub. Here's another recruitment vendor, Research Study Trial, IRT. In this case, this particular sponsor controls their own IRT. Maybe it's white labeled from another vendor. That's another advanced thing, is this white labeling. So you might get an IRT like 4G, and this is just hypothetical. I don't know if this is true. 4G has the technology, but the sponsor or the CRO wants to put their brand on it, but they're using the technology of 4G, but no one knows they're using 4G except the sponsor or CRO who's paying 4G for the white labeling of it. So that's another thing that's goes on a lot. So these things are ubiquitous. There is money to be made, and there's probably, once you reach a steady state of a particular technology, there's probably only a handful of established players that are all competing within the same framework. So it does make things more consistent and more easier to project, like what costs are actually going to be. The ones that are difficult to project are the emerging technologies. And I think that's where the race usually is for startups and innovation, is the new waves, like in this case, AI. But AI for what? AI for patient recruitment, AI for budget negotiation, AI for study streamline, study startup streamline, AI for tracking study leads. I mean, you could have AI for anything, AI for selecting sites. The money's going to be there once it gets stabilized, proof that it works and proof that there's a demand, you get a lot of consolidation and then basically a new baseline for what those services or technology should cost. Long video, but what do you want from a moderate to advanced video? And there's a lot. I mean, this could be a 6-hour video. Like, subscribe, comment, share. Congrats to episode 100 with Daniel. Thank you guys for watching. Bye-bye.